The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I was just about to brag about having no glitches planned for today's show. Yesterday, we had some interesting happenings. Our mic stand started to slowly but surely tilt over as I was speaking there in the first segment. And then when Sam came in to fix it, it was missing a screw or something, and so he was in here much, much too longer, much longer than he was supposed to be here. But I had an excuse. It was a holiday here in the UK and in the United States as well. So we had our junior varsity on staff yesterday. Today, we have brought back the varsity team, but already we've made a mistake. I got here about 30 seconds too late, so I apologize for that. The show, however, will go on. This is, after all, live. It's live every morning in Oklahoma time, just after 7 o'clock, of course, here in the UK. It starts just after 1 o'clock over in the Netherlands. We have quite a few listeners in the Netherlands. They listen in, some of them do, live just after 2 o'clock European time. So it's great to have all of you listening in. And for those of you that listen in later to the podcast, we certainly appreciate you tuning in as well. Well, I've talked in recent weeks about the Iran nuke deal, and particularly about this false narrative that was created by Ben Rhodes and a few others, how that when Rouhani came into power in 2013, he was supposedly the moderate, and the White House at that time really played this up and then came out and said, well, we've got to pursue this deal with Iran because they're shifting more to be moderate. They're not as extreme or as radical as they used to be. Well, last week you had this appointment of this hardline Iranian cleric to really one of the top positions in the Iranian government, and quite a few articles that have been coming out since then about this so-called shift to a more moderate government. It's not happening, contrary to what some are saying. It's just as radical and as extreme as ever. I mean, this Iranian cleric, he was a part of the power structure of Iran since the revolution in 1979. And now he heads up the Assembly of Experts, the Iranian Assembly. It says in the Wall Street Journal, this is from last week, the selection of 89-year-old Ayatollah Ahmed Janadi, an ultra-conservative who called for the execution of opposition activists after Iran's disputed 2009 election and encouraged Iraqis to become suicide bombers against U.S. forces in Iraq in 2003, signals the power hardliners still wield in Iran despite a recent nuclear deal with world powers. I mean, they've struck the nuclear deal with the West, but it's the same hardliners in the top positions. If anything, it's shifting more to the right. It said there in that quote I gave to you. I mean, he was in favor of executing all opposition activists from that 2009 uprising, just from a few years ago. He's an old man, 89 years old. But this is not someone who had extreme views way back in 79 or when he was a young man. He wanted to execute political dissidents. He said this in 2007, just a couple of years before that uprising. At the end of the day, we are an anti-American regime. America is our enemy, and we are the enemies of America. The hostility between us is not a personal matter. It's a matter of principle. I mean, this is a principle that we stand by. We are the enemy of America. He now heads up the Assembly of Experts in 2008. He said, you cried death to the Shah, and indeed he died. You cried death to Israel, and it is now on its deathbed. You cried death to America, and before long, Allah willing, the prayer for the dead will be recited over it. Death to Israel, death to America. More recently, just in 2014, he said, death to America is the first option on our table. This is the slogan of our entire people without exception. This is the number one slogan. And just last week, this man received 55 votes in the 88-seat assembly. That's a 63% majority. That's an overwhelming majority in the government that now is supposed to be moderate because Rouhani's there. 63% of the assembly voted for this man to lead the assembly, the Ayatollah Ahmed Jannati. He's now heading it up. This is from the American Interest. Pretty good article here that was just posted the other day. Moderation, it says, postponed in Iran. He's writing in response to Jannati's election just last week. He says here, what's really going on in Iran has almost nothing to do with the happy-clappy beltway talk about peaceable mullahs and the kinder, gentler theocracy they aspire to create. Unfortunately, hardline values are hardwired into the Iranian regime and Iranian foreign policy, and no White House spinmeister can make that grim reality go away. Well, they're certainly attempting to. They definitely are putting the spin on it. I mean, I just had Sam try to search for some articles or sound bites on this Jannati. It's been a week now, and it was hard to find anything substantial. There's quite a few in the Israeli press writing about it, of course. But it's as if everyone else in the West, Western press officials, it's as if they're just yawning when things like this happen. And then you have the White House spinmeisters trying to make it go away or to just ignore it. This is what the spokesperson at the State Department, Mark Toner, said last week in response to this Jannati being voted in to head up the assembly.
Oh, do you have faith in Iran's internal democratic procedures?
Let me see if I have anything picky to say about that.
You regard Iran as an ally in the fight against
terrorism. You're talking about, yeah. No. Have at it, guys. you know, we follow domestic events in Iran closely, as you know. But we don't have any comment at this point on the outcome of the leadership elections of the Assembly of Experts.
I could have set that up better, but it basically was just back and forth laughter and chit-chat. And then finally, the only statement that he could make is that we have no statement to make at this time. We don't have any comment. One reporter you heard there asked if he has faith in Iran's internal democratic procedures. Do you have faith in the way that their government works? I mean, here is this hardliner calling for the execution of any dissidents, of any that would rise up in that 2009 uprising. He's now heading up the Assembly of Experts, voted in with an overwhelming majority, and it doesn't really faze the State Department. No big deal. We don't really have anything to say at this time. We follow it closely, but there's nothing really to comment on here. This American Interest piece, coming back to this, it says the Islamic Republic needs an ideological bond to keep the country together. And that is what the Shia identity does. As a Shia state, the government in Tehran can appeal to a broader public than just those who would be motivated by Persian nationalism. Just as communism helped hold the Soviet Union's many restive ethnic groups together, if Tehran sacrificed its hard Shia edge, it would face the same kind of centrifugal forces that have torn apart many other multi-ethnic conglomerate states in recent decades, from the Soviet Union to Yugoslavia and to now Syria and Iraq. So it's the radical ideology that's holding all these ethnic groups in place. This is what keeps the regime in power. This is what spreads its popularity, even in the region anyway, beyond Iranian borders. Not all in the region, of course. There's the very hardline resistance against it coming from the Sunni states. But as you know from prophecy, Psalm 83 brings this out, there's a divide in this world of Islam between the Sunnis and the Shias. And it has to hold on to this radical Shia religion to keep it all together. It says, so an Iranian moderate leadership would risk losing, looking like Gorbachev's regime when he broke with communist ideology. The Soviet Union crumbled under his hands. Convinced hardliners and fervent true believers aren't the only members of the power elite who won't want to do a Gorbachev. Pragmatists will also see the need for Shia ideology, even if they personally would rather live in a more liberal atmosphere. They see the value in it, just for the sake of unity. It says here, but if Iran's unity is linked to hardline Shia politics, its international position is even more tightly wedded to hatred of America and Israel. Iran wants to become a global great power by dominating the oil-rich Middle East. This is its aim. This is its ambition. Its foreign policy is that of hatred toward America and Israel, and it's not going to abandon this. And the facts on the ground prove it. Look who they're voting in to head up the assembly. He's going to cast his vote on the next Ayatollah. It says, but working with Shia isn't enough. Iran needs to legitimate its presence as an aspiring hegemon in a mostly Arab, mostly Sunni part of the world. This is where the rage against the U.S. and Israel comes in. Iran positions itself as the only true leader of Islamic resistance to American imperialism and Zionist aggression. And so what he's getting at here is that there's those, I mean, even in some Sunni states, that sympathize with this, of course. The hatred for America and for the so-called Zionist aggression. This helps discredit Sunni powers and clerics who are either ineffective or compliant allies of the U.S., the charge Iran levels against Saudi Arabia. If Iran drops the anti-Americanism and anti-Zionism from its foreign policy as part of a moderating trend, it doesn't have an ideological leg to stand on in the struggle for hearts and minds in the modern Middle East. I mean, that's the great struggle that's going on here. It's the battle for Muslim minds. And they're winning that battle. There's this other article here. This was in the Washington Post the other day. Iran's Holocaust denial is part of a malevolent strategy. It says here, anti-Semitism was part of Iran's inception. Well, I can paraphrase some of this. It's just talking about how going back to the revolution of 1979, I mean, there was this hatred for Jews and disdain for America from the very beginning. And it's not diminished with the election of Rouhani in 2013. It's just as radical and as extreme as ever before. Only now the sanctions have been lifted. Only now they've been welcomed back into the international community. It says, since the Ayatollah's death, Tehran's efforts to delegitimize the Jewish state have continued no matter who among the ruling elite has had the upper hand. It doesn't matter if it's Rouhani or Ahmadinejad. The mullahs have it the way it's been since 1979. It says, in foreign affairs, this antagonism to Israel enforces the clerical regime's claims to regional leadership. So he's bringing out some of the same points as that previous one from the American interest. It says, in particular, Iran needs anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial conferences that brandish its Islamist credentials to compete against the Saudi propaganda machine which is running full throttle against the Shiites, depicting Iranians as Muslim heretics and Persian usurpers eyeing Arab lands. So there's this battle between these two ideologies. It says, finally, in the clerical regimes, anti-Semitism will grow worse as the rewards of the nuclear deal increase. See, now that the money's flowing in, well, they can trumpet their message all the more loudly. Now that the nuclear deal has been made, it's going to grow worse and worse. They're being rewarded for this behavior. The mullahs no longer have to worry how the regime's hatred of Jews plays in the West. The buffoonish character of former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is gone, and sanctions are falling. The U.S.-educated Zarif is adept at handling Western officials and journalists. In his capable hands, Holocaust festivals become yet another reason to support Rouhani's so-called moderates. It's amazing what's happening. He says, finally, and again, it makes, in this case, the same point as that previous article. He says, what matters most is the war for Muslim minds. And the clerical regime intends to exploit anti-Semitism for all that it's worth. And so that's what's played out in Iran just over the last week. And what's interesting is right about the same time, I mean, this Ahmed Jannati, the assembly voted him in last Tuesday. I guess that would have been, May 24th or something? And then last Wednesday, Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, he entered into a coalition with Avigdor Lieberman. I mean, these two haven't exactly been best of buds in recent years. But they came together in an effort to strengthen the coalition of Netanyahu's ruling government. And so now he's got 66 of the Knesset's 120 members. A relatively slim majority. But he sees this, Netanyahu does, he sees this as a much-needed move to stabilize the government in Israel in order to better serve Israel's security needs. And Lieberman's going to now fill the position as defense minister, which has quite a few Western officials and quite a few members of the Western media up in arms. Now this they'll write about. This development they will talk about. And they will talk about how extreme and how hard line and how hard right this is. This is a clip from the press conference last week when Netanyahu and Lieberman announced the deal or the strengthening of this coalition. The first voice you'll hear is Netanyahu, followed by Lieberman.
My government remains committed to pursuing peace with the Palestinians, pursuing peace with all our neighbors. My policy has not changed. We'll continue to pursue every avenue for peace while ensuring the safety and security of our citizens. I believe the developments in the regions have created new challenges for us all, but I also believe that they've created new opportunities for peace, and I intend to seize those opportunities. A broader government, a more stable government, will make it easier to do so.
I would like to express appreciation to the Prime Minister that we succeeded to overcome all disputes, all disagreements that we had in the past. I think it's very crucial, especially today, to provide more stability for this coalition. I don't have any doubts that it will be more stable and more efficient coalition from the next week, from this day. My intention to provide security, and of course, all of us, we have commitment, strong commitment to the peace, to the final status agreement, to the understanding between us and our neighbors. And I hope to be also very cooperative and efficient in this direction.
A lot in the Israeli press quite a few of them were surprised at him switching over to English for a good part of this press conference. It's not as unusual for Netanyahu to do that because he speaks so eloquently in English. But for Lieberman, too, to chime in, obviously these two were reaching out to Western officials and to the Western media. They knew there'd probably be a lot of critics. Well, not just abroad, but also at home in Israel. That this new coalition was going to take on a more hawkish stance, a more hardline stance. And so you hear Netanyahu there saying that he wants peace. There's no change in policy. Lieberman comes along and says, this is to bring stability to the government. And we still have a strong commitment to peace and the final status agreement and all these things. That's what those two said last Wednesday. And as it happens, when the spokesperson for the State Department, Mark Toner, was asked about this development, this time he did have something to say.
We have seen reports and agreements been reached to expand the coalition. We've also seen reports from Israel describing it as the most right-wing coalition in Israel's history. And we also know that many of its ministers have said they oppose a two-state solution. This raises legitimate questions about the direction it may be headed in, and what kind of policies it may adopt. But ultimately, we're going to judge this government based on its actions.
The most right-wing coalition in Israel's history, and it raises all kinds of legitimate questions, he says, about the direction that Israel is headed in. The direction that Israel is headed in. There's no concern about the direction of Iran. We don't have any comment. We don't have any comment about this Ayatollah Ahmed Janadi. That was Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, of course, I actually do have a statement on this after the reporter asked. Yes, I do have a statement. And then he shifted his papers around, and here was this prepared statement describing Israel's current government as the most right-wing in history. It's Israel that we need to be worried about, you see. It's Israel that's the problem. It's Israel that we have legitimate questions about. It says a lot, doesn't it, about what the United States thinks. The current administration, anyway, thinks that the real problem is in the Middle East. David Horovitz at the Times of Israel, he drew attention to these two responses. The one from Mark Toner, the non-response, with respect to the Iranian leader. And then the response last Wednesday, after Lieberman joined the coalition of Netanyahu, even after Lieberman, as he said there, pledged to peace or committed himself to support the peace, the pursuit of peace with the Palestinians. This is how Horovitz wrote about it May 29th, just the other day. What's perhaps most telling about the response from Washington is that it was so very different to the administration's response one day earlier. That's what makes it so dramatic. This difference, this stark difference. Just one day earlier, on Tuesday, Horovitz says, a day before Netanyahu and Lieberman signed their deal, Iran's assembly of experts chose Ayatollah Ahmed Janadi as its new chairman. The assembly oversees the actions of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, and come the day, we'll select Khamenei's successor. That makes Janadi one of the most powerful figures in Iran, arguably the most powerful. And he's an extremist. You talk about a radical right-wing coalition. It's in Tehran right now. It certainly is. And yet, what did the United States have to say about this man being selected to head up the assembly?
You know, we follow domestic events in Iran closely, as you know, but we don't have any comment at this point on the outcome of the leadership elections of the Assembly of Experts.
The U.S. has no comment about him being elected and becoming arguably the most powerful, one of the most, certainly, hardliners in the Islamic Republic. Horovitz says, given that the United States last year led the diplomatic process that culminated in an agreement to rein in but not dismantle Iran's rogue nuclear program, given that President Barack Obama has been urging Iran to move toward a more constructive relationship with the world community, given that Iran is a state sponsor of terrorism and a regional troublemaker, given that Iran continues to develop its ballistic missile program, you might be forgiven for thinking that the selection of the radically hostile Janadi would raise, quote, legitimate questions about the direction, unquote, in which Iran may be headed and what kind of policies it may adopt. Those two quotes there at the end of his article, of course, taken from the remarks made by Mark Toner after it was announced that Avigdor Lieberman would join the coalition of Prime Minister Netanyahu. And as he brings out in his piece, the legitimate questions that we ought to be raising, they're concerning what's happening in the Assembly of Experts among the mullahs in the Iranian government, the regime. Besides all of that, of course, it says a lot, doesn't it? When you see Ephraim and Manasseh in this case, turning against Judah, as it says in Isaiah 9 and verse 21. You see this brotherhood the prophet Hosea brings out, the brotherhood being broken. Israel's being left alone, abandoned by the United States. I think it was Carolyn Glick a few years ago who said that President Obama's goal here is not to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear power. Ultimately, the goal is to weaken the state of Israel, to undermine the state of Israel. And when you see what happened over the course of this past week, the non-response on Tuesday, followed by the harsh criticism on Wednesday. Why, this is one of the most right-wing coalitions in Israel's history. You can't very well fault Ms. Glick for saying what she said. I think that was back in 2013. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. Keep sending those emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace. And yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. this city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Welcome back to the program. We'll carry on with a Bible study here to finish things out for today's show. This morning, I was reading through this was lesson three of the correspondence course. There's a great little message from the editor in that lesson, starting on the inside of the front cover, carrying through to the back page. But it was a hopeful message, a message about keeping our focus on the greater purpose being worked out here below, even as we see all of these terrifying prophecies unfold before our eyes. I'll start over in Luke 21, if you'd like to read along with me. Luke chapter 21, the Gospel of Luke, and picking it up here in the middle of the section, verse 23, it says, "But woe unto them that are with child." This verse, or rather this chapter, together with Matthew 24, Mark 13, Christ just lays it out. He tells us all that's to happen before he returns to this earth. That's what lesson three of the correspondence course is about. The spectacular return of Jesus Christ to this earth, just as he promised. He said, "If I go, I'm coming back." That's John 14, 3. And then in the first chapter of Acts, you'll recall the angels there talking to the disciples saying, "Why do you wonder? Or why do you marvel? He's going to come back in the same way that he's leaving. He's going to come back to the Mount of Olives, the very same mount that he left from." Of course, that's also mentioned in Zechariah 14. So here in Luke 21, he's laying out all of these things that are to be fulfilled before he returns. And it says, "But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." You can, as my father brought out in that message from the editor, you can feel these times upon us, the times of the Gentiles. And you look around at the nations of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, or the United States and Britain, little Israel in the Middle East, that is actually Judah. And you have to wonder, why is everybody against or ganging up against these nations? Why? Why, when you have someone like Gennady voted in, and people in the West, Western officials, journalists, they just yawn. "Oh, no big deal." As he carries out his plans to bring death to Israel, death to America. There's a spirit behind all of this, as I think you know. But we're facing the times of the Gentiles. That's why the nations are against the United States and Britain and little Israel. And he says to us in his church, "You're going to see the sword. You're going to feel the storm. We're already seeing the outer edges of it." What a work God has given his church to do, to proclaim these prophecies, to warn this world. Verse 25 says, "And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. For the powers of heaven shall be shaken. That's what we're entering into. Unprecedented suffering. It's coming upon all the world, not just those of us in Israelite nations. And you can see, even from some of the few commentators that actually have their eyes open to what's happening. I read a couple of them in the first segment. That Horowitz piece at the Times of Israel, but also those other two from the Washington Post and the American Interest. They know what's going on in Iran. They know what's going on in the regime. And you have so many in the White House, as I say, or as I've been saying, that are working to cover it up, that are working to conceal the truth, that are working to build up Iran. Even as we lash out at Israel. Well, verse 27, this is what it builds toward. Verse 27, and then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. He said, if I go, I'm coming again. And here he explains what happens leading up to his return. Now, all these heavenly signs, as he says there in verses 25 and 26, men's hearts failing them for fear. And then this, you'll see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and glory. And verse 28 says, and when these things begin to come to pass, all these things, not just verse 27, but all that's leading up to it as well. When these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draws near. And the point my father made in that message from the editor is that we can't get depressed when we see all of this death and destruction setting in. We can't hang our heads and get caught up in the calamity. Even though we know it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. God says, lift up your heads. Lift up your heads. In that message from the editor, I think this whole message or section was taken out of the Prophesy Again booklet, if you'd like to locate it in the booklet as well. My father says, God knows our human nature, and he's warning us not to get discouraged. Don't let this get you down, he's telling us. Lift up your head, because your redemption draws near. Jesus Christ is about to return. Don't lose your hope or your positive attitude. We can't lose that hope. We're drawing so close to the end of it all, for this present evil age. And even we who've had our minds open to the truth, we really have to battle against that negative pull. And we can't just zero in on the bad news. There's plenty of it. In fact, in that section, in the correspondence course, my father even draws attention to little Israel in the Middle East and how that they've just been having to cope with this constant threat coming from terrorists, coming from nation states that want to see them destroyed. So many of them living in fear, worried. Worried when the next suicide bomb will go off. So many of them that have had loved ones killed or kidnapped. So many of them living in despair. And then to see the U.S. administration just basically leave them high and dry, these long-time, strong allies. And now the U.S., the current administration, ever so quick, to lash out at Israel for forming a larger coalition, and not even a peep coming from the administration about this radical hardliner that now heads up the Assembly of Experts, one of the most powerful positions in the Iranian government. Well, this passage here in Luke 21, it ties right in with Isaiah 40. There's a verse there, I read it a couple of weeks ago, verse 26 of Isaiah 40, that says, "Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who has created these things, that brings out their host by number? He calls them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power. No one fails. He's strong in power." It's that same strong hand, as it says in verse 10 of Isaiah 40, that's going to intervene in the affairs of mankind. That's the strength that we need dwelling in our minds, in our lives, in our families. Be strong in the Lord, as Paul said in Ephesians 6. Lift up your eyes on high. You might remember this article my father wrote a while back, I forget which year, about the push to land on the moon and how it just galvanized the whole world. And it got human beings looking up into outer space, into God's creation. He mentioned this verse, I think, when he wrote that personal. Lift up your eyes on high. Consider the heavens, as David said in Psalm 8. Consider the work of God's hands. Consider the moon and the stars. Consider man. Why would God create man, David wondered. Why would he create this little, tiny man? Well, David understood a little bit about the incredible human potential and how that we were made to have dominion over the works of God's hands. That God actually created us to lift up our heads, to lift up our eyes, and to consider the heavens. The Apostle Paul, as you probably know, he paraphrased what David said there in Psalm 8. If you look at Hebrews 2, in fact, he expanded on it. Wonderful passages when put together, Psalm 8 together with Hebrews 2. But let's just conclude over in Romans chapter 8. Also, the Apostle Paul's writings, Romans chapter 8 and verse 17. So much is said here about these heavens, considering the heavens, the work of God's fingers. It says in verse 17, Romans 8, "And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may be also glorified together with Jesus Christ, joint heirs with Jesus Christ, who was crucified and resurrected to life after 3 days and three nights, who dwells at the right hand of God right now, and who will soon return to this earth, as he promised. The saints are going to be with him at his return after that first resurrection. The saints are going to rule with Christ for 1,000 years during the millennium. Once the kingdom of God, once God's government is established on earth, glorified together with him." That's what the Bible says. Paul continued, "For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us." Who talks about this, even in the world of Christianity? Who talks about the glory to be revealed in man? About man being joint heirs with Christ? And then Paul goes on and says here in verse 19, the Revised Standard Version, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of him who subjected it in hope, because the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God. Of course, there's a lot that happened even before the creation of man. There's a reason why there's this bondage to decay out in the universe. There's a reason why the planets are lifeless and dead. There's a reason for that. It was because of Lucifer's rebellion. It was because of sin. And yet Paul says here, we know that the whole creation has been groaning in travail together until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves. That's talking about true Christians. That's talking about spirit-begotten human beings. We ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait for the birth as sons, groaning inwardly, eyes held high, heads lifted up. These are positive people here who have their sights set on this glorious calling. Herbert Armstrong wrote in Mystery of the Ages, "What an amazing, marvelous revelation of knowledge. No more amazing, awesome, eye-opening passage could be written. It's so astonishingly revealing, one doesn't fully grasp it reading quickly through." And then later in the same book, he says, "This passage indicates precisely what all astronomers and scientific evidence indicate. The suns are as balls of fire, giving out light and heat, but the planets, except for this earth, are in a state of death, decay, and futility, but not forever. Waiting until converted humans are born the children of God, born into the very divine family of God, forming the kingdom of God." Put together all these scriptures, and you begin to grasp the incredible human potential. Our potential, Mr. Armstrong said, is to be born into the God family, receiving total power. We are to be given jurisdiction over the entire universe. The entire universe. That's what Paul is saying here in Romans 8. We didn't even go through Hebrews 2. You can look at that on your own time. Psalm 8, Isaiah 40. We read from Luke 21. This is what we need to be lifting up our eyes and focusing on. Verse 22 again, it says, "For we know," this is the King James, "for we know that the whole creation groans and travails in pain together until now." And Mr. Armstrong about this verse says, it's as if the creation is the mother and God is the father. Anyway, the whole thrust of the passage is that when we, converted humans, are born of God, then having the power and glory of God, we're going to do as God did when this earth had been laid waste and empty. Talking about what happened with the rebellion of Lucifer and the angels. Waste and empty, or the Hebrew words being tohu and bohu. You'll have to study that on your own time there in Genesis 1 and verse 2. But then we learn from other scriptures how that after that rebellion happened and destruction and decay set in, God renewed the face of the earth. The earth he renewed. The earth he prepared for man's existence. One tiny little planet, just like a pinpoint in the vast universe that God created, less than a pinpoint. And here in Romans 8, look at what God plainly reveals. It's as if, as Mr. Armstrong said, it's as if the whole universe is out there like a mother just anxiously waiting for the 7,000-year plan for man to be completed and for the earth to be baptized so that God's family can then go right on out into the universe to all of the planets. As my father brings out in that booklet, Prophesy Again, this earth is just the testing ground. It's like the launching pad. And so you can see why we've got to lift up our heads. We've got to lift up our eyes. We've got to look at what God has in store for us, what God has created, what God's purpose is. Where are these prophecies that we talk often about on this program are leading? We've got to see beyond it. Lift up your eyes on high and behold who has created these things. In Mystery of the Ages, Herbert Armstrong said, could the whole universe with its myriad of other planets have been created for the eventual purpose of sustaining life? We're not told specifically by revelation in God's word whether it was or not. But what we are told throws additional light on why God decided to create man. Well, put this together, as I say, with Prophesy Again. Go and reread that booklet. See what my father says there about Ephesians 3:9 and other verses. What a calling. What a future. And yet so many in God's church, so many of God's people have fallen away from this truth, from this vision. Right here, just in the last few years, before Christ sets foot on the Mount of Olives, returning in the exact way that he left 2,000 years ago, finally here in Mystery of the Ages, it says, what these wonderful passages imply and indicate goes far beyond the amount specifically revealed. We are to be given jurisdiction over the entire universe. The entire universe. What are we going to do then? These scriptures indicate we shall impart life to billions and billions of dead planets as life has been imparted to this earth. We shall create as God directs and instructs. What a future. You can see why you get to the end of the book there, Mystery of the Ages, I mean. And Mr. Armstrong concludes by saying, well, now we come to the beginning. The 7,000-year plan is complete. And we launch out into the universe. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream, as you know, is at our websites, thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. Send us your emails as the week unfolds. Send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll try to read some of those coming up on perhaps Friday. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you again tomorrow. We'll